everybody. Welcome to episode 361 of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is a Marvel Monday episode, and I'm going to be talking about a few of the books that came out last Wednesday, October 17th from Marvel, and spoilers. And I'm not going to go too heavily into detail on these stories, but you do probably want to, at least if you want to not be spoiled whatsoever, you're probably going to want to read these books before you listen to this episode. So it's a lot of number ones, but actually the first book I'm going to talk about is issue four. It's issue four of The Life of Captain Marvel. And we did have the writer, Margaret Stoll, on last week, so I hope you all got a chance to listen to that. It was very enjoyable to hear Margaret talk about just how special this series is, just how many people, even if they're not directly involved with creating the book, they're kind of a spiritual creator of it, if you will, in that they kind of open themselves up and shared life experiences with Margaret, both in terms of how they relate to Carol themselves and things that have happened in their own family life growing up and such that have kind of helped Margaret craft this story. So we're going to be talking about issue four of that. And there is somewhat of a big spoiler in it that I'm going to spoil. So again, if you haven't read it, and you haven't heard about it, because it was kind of all over the online comics community last week when the issue dropped. So if it hasn't been spoiled for you yet and you don't want it to be, you're probably going to want to skip this episode, or at least skip the first 5 minutes or so to move on to the other reviews, so you can get a chance to read it for yourself, because I feel like it's a great discovery. I'm not even going to call it a change to the origin, because it's definitely additive, which Margaret talked about that on the episode as well. It doesn't change Carol, or it doesn't go back and say anything that's happened before has been invalidated. It's completely additive, and I'll talk about it when I get into more detail in the issue in just a second. But I want to let you know the other books I'm going to be talking about: X-Men Black, Mystique number one. Also, there's a Venom Annual number one, The Unstoppable Wasp number one, and Shuri number one. So let's go ahead and kick things off with The Life of Captain Marvel. Aforementioned writer Margaret Stoll. Pencils for the present day sequence, which is most of the issue, by Carlos Pacheco. Present day inks by Rafael Fontarez. We've got pencils and inks for the flashbacks by Erica DeRusso. Colors by Marcio Menez, and letters by Clayton Cowles. So as we discovered, or as was hinted at the end of the last issue of Life of Captain Marvel number 3, it turns out that Carol's mother has been Kree all along. So previously the origin of Carol as Ms. Marvel was supposedly attributed to this Kree device that exploded, and that explosion involved both Carol Danvers as well as Captain Marvel, the first Captain Marvel, the classic Bronze Age hero who eventually died of cancer in Jim Starlin's graphic novel, The Death of Captain Marvel. So, as I said, it was always suspected that Carol got her powers because she was caught in this explosion, and some of Captain Marvel's DNA bonded with Carol's DNA and gave her these powers. No. That explosion, in fact, kind of triggered the release of these powers that Carol had kept hidden, that she wasn't even aware of all these years. She had completely forgotten. So, come to find out, Carol's mother is actually a very skilled and very well and highly trained warrior of the Kree Empire. And she had been sent to Earth as sort of a scouting person. You know, the Kree are very much a military society and culture. So Carol's mother had been sent out as, I can almost think of it, not necessarily a scouting party, but certainly a, you know, a forward agent of the Kree. And she ended up falling in love with Carol's father and sort of abandoned her mission. And now those decisions that she's made are coming back to haunt her in a way. So again, I feel like this change to Carol's origin is really additive, and I think it's going to give Carol a real sense of who she is and a little bit more of a sense of legacy. And it also paints her father in a different light. You know, we know Carol's had a pretty tough childhood from previous stories that have been told, and her father wasn't the easiest guy to get along with. But in this different context, we kind of understand why Carol's father was the way he was, why he was so protective, and why he did seem to want to, you know, like he didn't want to pay for Carol to go to college. He wanted to keep her under his thumb, so to speak. And it always seemed like he was just being chauvinistic and didn't value Carol the way he valued Carol's brothers. But in this new context, it makes a lot more sense, right? And there are other complications of family and relationship that Margaret goes into that I'm not going to go into detail here, but that really add to the story as well, in as much as they are a comment on the relationship between Carol's parents and how that relationship changed over time and really had to change. And again, it's very complex family issues that I think a lot of us can relate to, even if the issues in our own families or issues we had growing up aren't exactly the same as the issues that the Danvers faced. You can still relate to the complexity of it, right? You can still relate to the fact that oftentimes in relationships and marriages that last, you know, for decades, the person you first met and fell in love with isn't necessarily the same person, you know, years and years down the line, right? Identity changes as life occurs, and you go from being a girlfriend or a boyfriend to a husband or a wife, and then a mother and a father, and then, you know, your identity may change based on profession and different things like that, right? It's not that anything that came before is erased, just like with Carol's origin, with this change, it's not erased, but it's additive. There's things that are added on that can bring out other aspects and different dimensions and ways of relating to people. So again, I feel like this is a really special series. I think it's really setting Carol up to see her own self in a new light, as well as readers to kind of see her in a different way. And it's perfect timing because, as we all know, the Captain Marvel movie is about to hit theaters here in a few months. And we also have Kelly Thompson as a new writer for Captain Marvel going forward. And from everything that Margaret has told me, it looks like that series by Kelly is really going to hit the ground running and be a really fun look at Carol and her abilities and her powers and her place in the Marvel Universe going forward. So again, I hope you guys are all checking out Life of Captain Marvel. It's one of the best titles that Marvel's putting out right now, along with Immortal Hulk. So I hope you're all digging it. All right. Next book I'm going to talk about is X-Men Black Mystique number one. So these X-Men Black one-shots are basically a chance for some of the X-creators to give us a look at the different villains of the Marvel Universe. X-Men villains, I should say. We've gotten X-Men Black Magneto. We've gotten X-Men Black Mojo. I think there's a Juggernaut issue coming out. This one is Mystique. It's written by Seanan McGuire with art by Marco Falla, colors by Jesus Abertov, letters by Joe Caramagna. And it's entitled One Short Day. And it is rather short, so to speak. I mean, it's still a full, you know, 30-page comic or whatever it is, you know, as these one-shots tend to be. But it's told and paced so tightly by Seanan McGuire that it really feels like a relatively quick read, if not a short story. It's narrated in the first person by Mystique herself, and it it kind of follows her as she, it's kind of like a day in the life, right? And it gives great insight into who Mystique is as a character. She's kind of always working, right? You know, that, that acronym or that saying in sales, ABC, right? Always be closing, you know, no matter what you're doing, always be trying to close that sale. It's kind of like the way I look at Mystique here. She's always acting. She's always in disguise. She's always pretending to be someone that she's not, to the point where you would worry that somebody like that, somebody living their life the way Mystique is living it, is that they would lose themselves, right? They would be so busy being all these different identities that they would lose themselves. But what's great about the story that McGuire is telling is that Mystique has such a strong personality and such a strong sense of self and is so competent and has been doing what she does for so long that no matter who she is, it is always a mask, right? It is always her acting and her honing her craft, and she never loses sight of the objective, right? And the objective is whatever Mystique wants it to be. And the fact that whatever she's going after is the most important thing. And that's what her driving force is. Somewhat of a sense of ambition or a sense of constantly trying to prove herself, I think, to herself more than anyone else. So it's a great story about Mystique going after something again to better herself, right? To whether she's selling it to the highest bidder or it's giving her power, she infiltrates an organization to steal this information. And she also rescues a mutant, a young mutant that is being held prisoner in that situation. She's not a hero, right? She's not in there to rescue this mutant for the sake of rescuing this mutant because it's the right thing to do. What she really does, as we come to find out, is that she's covering herself, right? Like, she rescues this mutant, and yes, the mutant is better off for not having been a prisoner anymore and possibly being executed. But at the same time, when you look back at the infiltration and the things that Mystique does, if anything were to ever come back, if anyone were to ever look for a person to blame, this young mutant is going to be blamed. No one's ever going to look for Mystique. No one's ever going to know Mystique was even there. And that's the point, right? That's kind of what she does. And it's illustrated really, really well in this issue, both literally and figuratively. Literally by McGuire, in that there are so many sequences in the story where Mystique slips from one identity to the next, like from one panel to the next. And before the end of the page, she's taken another identity, right? It goes to show just how fluid and how quickly Mystique can just trade from one identity to the next. But again, like I mentioned, being able to do it in such a way that she never loses herself in it. She's always 100% aware of who she is. And then literally illustrated by Marco Fela, like really, really well. It's gorgeous art. It's very detailed. I was trying to think as I was reading it, his art reminds me of somebody else's art. And I think maybe it's Todd Knock, in that there's a little bit of a cartoony type style. You know, it's not like the hyper realistic art or even the almost kinetic house style of Jim Lee. It's really clean and beautiful with solid lines. And yeah, I think more than anybody, it does remind me of Todd Knock. And Fala does a great job of making Mystique look somewhat sexy, as well as really competent in the action scenes where she's vastly outnumbered at one point, and she takes no prisoners literally, and really kicks some butt. So it's a really great issue. I really enjoyed it. I'm not the biggest Mystique fan in the world, but after reading this, I'm more of a fan of her. I feel like I have a better understanding of the character than I ever have. And so, yeah, I think it's a really, really great issue. And also the colors, I should mention, by Jesus Obertov, pretty primary, which gives it a real classic comic book feel, which I really feel like this this color palette and these tones, and giving it this classic comic book feel, are perfectly suited for the story that McGuire is telling. So I got to imagine, if you're a Mystique fan, you got to love this issue, and you should probably be clamoring for your own Mystique title, right? Like, man, if this is what a Mystique title was, or if this was the first issue of a Mystique series, I definitely would pick up issue two. Like, that's how good this issue is. And again, that's coming from someone who's not the biggest Mystique fan in the world. So, all right, next up, I'm going to talk about Venom Annual number one. And for as long as Venom has been around, I was surprised to find out that he's never had an annual before. So this is written by a few different writers, because although it's sort of one story, there are little vignettes within it, right? And you'll understand what I mean in a minute. So as far as writers go, we have Donny Cates, David Michelinie, who is actually the first writer to ever write Venom, and Jeff Loveness and James Stocco. For artists, we have Kev Walker, Ron Lim, Ty Walker, and also James Stocco. He writes and draws his part of the book. And then inkers on Ron Lim is Scott Hanna. And then as far as colorists go, we have Chris Sotomayor, Rochelle Rosenberg on a couple of the issues. And then again, James Stocco colors his own stuff. So the way this story is told, it's framed as bar tales, so to speak. Like, we're in a bar in New York, and apparently it's a bar where a lot of supervillains hang out. We've got Boomerang and Black Hood and Scorpion and the Shocker, and they're all basically telling their stories. Black Cat is there as well, and they're all telling their stories of their run-ins with Venom, right? So each of the stories is illustrated by one of those artists. So it's kind of a crash course in who Venom was, at least at one point in his career. And I think it's a great jumping on point if you've never read Venom or you're not sure who he is. This gives a good, it's in no way a complete history, but it gives a good idea and a good sense of who Venom is. Because we start off with the first story from Black Cat, and she's kind of explaining how Venom went from being completely villainous to sort of developing this sense of warped sense of justice, you know, justice as vengeance. And really the only person he ever unjustly persecuted was Spider-Man. But we do see in the Black Cat story that, based on Black Cat's own actions, how Venom goes from wanting to kill her to kind of respecting her when she saves somebody who's innocent. So again, you're getting that idea. Okay, I kind of have an idea who Venom is. He's not completely devoid of sense of right or wrong, even if he does kind of look at Spider-Man as the ultimate enemy. And obviously we know Spider-Man is not a bad guy. The second story is probably my favorite. It's Venom in this very same bar at some point in the past, where he gets in a fight with Wolverine, which is pretty interesting, right? Because you can almost think of Venom and Wolverine as different sides of the same coin, so to speak. They both have their ability to kind of lose control and lash out, but they're both, at the end of the day, guided by, you know, right or wrong, guided by their own sense of what is the morally correct thing to do and what is crossing the line, right? And so I think that Wolverine has a unique perspective in the way he looks at Venom. And throughout the course of their fight, you can tell that Wolverine is trying to impart knowledge to Venom. And he tells him, you know, no matter who we have revenge on, and despite the fact that you believe they deserve to suffer, at some point you have to ask yourself, is this all I'm going to be? Just this revenge monster, this revenge motivated being, this vengeance machine, or am I going to try to rise above that and be something more, right? And so it's an interesting take. And the fact that it doesn't seem like Wolverine really sees Venom as a villain himself. So plus he refers to him as goo, which is just really cool, really funny. The third story is one about the Juggernaut facing Venom. This is the one that's probably the most out there, especially in terms of art. It's a way of looking at Venom that I've never seen before. And it's also kind of the most humorous of the stories and the one that really almost feels the most authentic, because the story that's being told and the way the events are being related don't match up with the illustrations that we see. It doesn't match up with the visual, right? Like the story that's being told doesn't match up with the story in the pictures. Because again, it's all perspective, right? Like it's this, you know, story of the Juggernaut fighting Venom and this guy who's a huge fan of the Juggernaut and wanting to make sure the Juggernaut is seen in the best sort of light. But when you look at the pictures tell a completely different story. So this was really enjoyable in that it was, kind of what you would expect with a bunch of criminals and liars telling stories, right? Like, yeah, the Juggernaut really kicked Venom's butt. But when you like actually follow what happens in the pictures, it's kind of the exact opposite, which was really fun as well. So if you are a fan of Venom or you don't know anything about the character at all, either way, I think this is an issue that's really... as I said, a really great jumping on point for somebody new. And if you are a fan of the character, kind of a good reminder of who Venom is. So the regular Venom series from Donny Cates and with art by Ryan Stegman, the first six issues are out and the first trade collecting those six issues is out. And I think issue 7 is just about to drop as well. So it's been... one of the hottest titles out. I haven't been reading it myself. I'm not a big Venom fan, but from all accounts, Donny Cates has been killing it on the title. So if you're curious what it's all about and kind of the sensibility of it, again, I would suggest you pick up this Venom annual, check it out, and find out if Donny's take on the character and what's going on with Venom is for you. All right, next book I'm going to talk about is The Unstoppable Wasp, number 1. And again, in the interest of full disclosure, I know nothing about the Unstoppable Wasp other than she's the long-lost daughter of Hank Pym. I'm not really sure how that works necessarily. Apparently, he was married at some point to some Russian woman named Nadia, and we never really knew about that. And apparently... they have a daughter named Nadia as well. So she's half Russian, but she's also really young. So again, I'm not sure how that timeline works out, but she's the new Unstoppable Wasp. And I feel like this is a book that's very much aimed at younger female readers. So I don't know that it's necessarily for me. It's not to say I didn't enjoy it or not to say that you won't enjoy it. As well, but let me give the creative team here and I'll talk a little bit about the book. It's written by writer Jeremy Whitley. The art is by Guru Haru. Letters are by Joe Caramagna. And it's very much almost a manga-esque style, but certainly Americanized. The eyes don't get too huge, but it's definitely very primary colors in the colors, you know, just real primary tones. And the art is relatively simple. And again, it's just really cartoony in style, and it's definitely a manga influence. So Nadia, as I said, seems to be like right around 16, young girl, super intelligent, and there is what's known as the girl, I think, program. That's what it's called, which means genius in action research lab. So it's a collective of girl prodigies that are using science and engineering to change the world. So it's really flipping the idea of, you know, men are the smartest and you know, girls don't have any good ideas and you know, just kind of flipping that stereotype on its head, which is really needed in this day and age. And it's not to say that this girl group only recruits women, because they're happy to take young boys who have great ideas as well. So that's kind of the backdrop and part of the story that's going on. And meanwhile, Nadia is also has her identity as the superhero, the Unstoppable Wasp, with the rest of the prodigies from Girl as kind of her support staff, if you will, her support team. And they have a very active role when Nadia takes on her persona as the Wasp. And this the best way I can sum up this title is it's just a lot of fun, right? And it's a book that, I mean, I don't know if they're purposely aiming it at younger readers, but it's not, there's not a lot of the soap opera stuff going on. I mean, there's a little bit of it, but this certainly feels like a book that you could give a younger reader, you know, a 10 or 12 year old that is interested in comics, especially a girl, and they're going to understand it, right? There's not going to be like adult themes and stuff like that that go over their head. So I feel like, in as much as we need the younger generation to fall in love with comics and fall in love with story and fall in love with these characters, this is a book that would service that really, really well. But again, it's not so over the top and so simplistic that somebody who's a longtime Marvel fan couldn't check it out as well, because this is a legacy character, and we do see characters like Jarvis and Janet Van Dyne, the first Wasp, show up. And it was really, really good. I didn't, as I said, didn't know what to expect. But I think that this is a book that I would be happy to give my 7-year-old daughter and have her check out, because I think it's ticking all the right boxes as far as, you know, a good story, interesting characters, really fun comic. And it's not preachy, you know, it's not saying, oh, girls can do anything boys can do and hitting you over the head with it, right? Like that's some context of the story, but it's not the main focus of the story. The main focus of the story is Nadia and her team of girl prodigies. And it just so happens they're all young, just so happens they're all female, and just so happens that they're all really, really smart. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. And again, you're not being hit over the head with it. But it can be inspiring in a way. So kudos to Jeremy Whitley and Guru Hiru for a really good first issue. And I'm going to be paying attention to this one in terms of sales. I'm curious to know how it's going to be received. All right, now on to the last book I'm going to talk about for this episode. And again, in the interest of full disclosure, I know nothing about Shuri. I haven't seen the Black Panther movie. I've heard that she was like the runaway breakout character of that movie, and everybody kind of loved her. And so it makes a lot of sense that Marvel would be creating a comic based on her, or have her star in her own comic. And this first issue serves as a great introduction. I feel like I'm not missing out on anything from having not seen the movie and having not previously read any of the Black Panther run by Reggie Hudland, where, and I think John Romita Jr. did the art, where Shuri was created. So again, introductory issue to the character, and it serves that purpose very, very well. You know, we learn about who Shuri is, the history of the character, some of the things that she's been through, her relationship with her brother is the Black Panther, T'Challa, is highlighted several times in the issue. So we get a real sense of just how much love there is between the characters and how much Shuri looks up to her brother and cares about her brother. And we also get a strong sense of what the nation of Wakanda is. I think that is done very, very well. It's such a juxtaposition of this this Afro culture, this African country that yet is still super advanced with this high technology, and the blending of it is really cool. It's and I imagine it's what a lot of people liked about the movie, right? How you could be true to these people and their African roots, but show that that doesn't make them primitive, right? So I feel like the book handles that very well. Also, and as I'm saying that, I'm realizing that I was going to reference the writer there, and I realized I didn't give the creative team. So let me do that really quickly before I go any further. So it's written by Neda Okorafor. Hope I'm saying that right. It's Okorafor. The art is by Leonardo Romero. The colors are by Jordi Belair and letters by Joe Sabino. So, again, a really great job by Netty to what I feel is a really good job of capturing the character. And again, I understand that I'm not a huge Shuri fan. I don't have history with the character, but I do feel like I got a great sense just in this one issue of who Shuri is. And she's not just some token little sister who super popular from the movie and has gotten her own title, right? She has history in the Marvel Universe. She has other things that she's gone through, and a lot of them are touched on here. And it really paints a picture of a very capable young woman who has some wisdom beyond her years based on these life experiences and these things that she's gone through. Now, there's something that happens at the end of the issue that sets up everything going forward with this title, I imagine. And I don't want to spoil it for you, because I think if you're a fan of Shuri, you're going to want to read the story and discover it for yourself. But I did hear a little pushback both on Unstoppable Wasp and on Shuri from some various people online, talking about the same old argument they make about tokenism and diversity for diversity's sake. And I would say, having read Unstoppable Wasp and having read Shuri, I didn't get that feeling at all. I got a feeling that these are their stories. They're interesting stories. They're fun stories. And I don't feel like they're weaker for having female leads as the characters. These are just the stories of these characters. And I thought they were, both the issues were done really, really well, and it's a lot to balance, right? I mean, with Unstoppable Wasp, you have to balance keeping it kind of light and fun, maybe aimed at a younger audience of readers, while still having a little bit of legacy feel and making it interesting for longtime Avengers fans. And with Shuri, you're balancing Shuri as a character with her history and what she's been through as a comic book character, and you're balancing that with fans that may be coming to the book from the movie. You know, they're fans of the character that way, and you want to incorporate enough of who Shuri was on the big screen to keep them interested as well. So I think that the entire creative team, Netty especially, have done a great job of balancing that, at least from my perspective. Again, keep in mind, I haven't seen the movie, but from what I know of the character in the movie, I think it's done really, really well. I think that the art by Leonardo Romero has done very well also. I think he's got a great sense of storytelling, and from panel to panel, the transitions are pretty seamless. And he brings a real sense of joy to the character as well. As far as the colors by Jordi Belair, I mean, I don't think there's a better colorist working in comics right now. And a lot of browns, a lot of yellows, and it certainly suits the atmosphere and the world of Wakanda. That mix of that African culture with high tech is done really, really well. Plus, there's a couple of flashback sequences where the colors go really primary, which are handled expertly by Jordy. I mean, she's just amazing. So I was pleasantly surprised by just how much I like this title. And it wasn't that I expected to dislike it for any kind of character reasons or anything. I just didn't know how much I would get out of it just because I had such a lack of knowledge of the character. But again, I think Nettie does a great job of touching on kind of the high points of Shuri's history as a character in comics, and she gives just enough there to make you interested enough if you're curious to go back and read some of her previous appearances to see the things that she's been through. But I don't think you necessarily need to. I think everything you need to know about this character and to keep reading going forward is contained within this issue itself. So if you're a fan of Black Panther, if you're a fan of Shuri, I'm sure you love this issue, and rightfully so, because I think it's done really, really well. All right, I think that's going to do it for this episode. Thanks for joining, everybody. As always, please tell your friends about us. Subscribe and rate us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whatever platform you use. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, all past episodes of the podcast are available on all those platforms, as well as at lrmonline.com. While you're at the site, please check out all the other pop culture coverage of your favorite and upcoming movies and TV shows. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. Next convention I'll be at, and my last convention for the year, is Los Angeles Comic Con coming up next weekend, the last weekend in October. I'm just going to be there on Saturday. I'm also going to be doing a panel on Saturday, noon. I believe it's room 304. It's the 80th anniversary of Superman panel, and it should be a whole lot of fun. So if you're going to be there, please let me know. I always love to meet up with listeners and talk a little comics and talk about the podcast, give you a comics for lanyard, grab a picture, all that kind of good stuff. So as I said, if you're going to be there on Saturday, let me know. Love to meet up. So once again, I want to thank everybody for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.